Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery on Round Rock, where we talk about games, comics, and other stuff on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And let's go to the show for this week. This is the Roguecast for Wednesday, May 27th. And not a lot of news in the news this week.
We don't need news.
We don't need news, but so we're going to real quick give an intro of the upcoming stuff for the store. Then we're going to jump into new comics, which there's a lot of comics to talk about this week.
It's a sexy comics week.
So our top of the show is Reading with Rogues, June 9th at what are we doing? Oh, we're doing Westside Ale House.
Right.
And we're going to do Rat Queens Volume 1 and 2, which is we have that in stock. Ladies Night is going to be June 10th. They're switching that to Wednesday. It's going to be the new Kirby Lane in Round Rock. Gaming with Rogues is the next week. It is on Monday, June 15th. That's going to be at BJ's Brewhouse, and it's going to be King of Tokyo. And Free RPG Day coming up is June 20th. That is a Saturday. And then the next Saturday, June 27th, will be our All Ages Awesomeness 5, which has a big guest list including Tom Balin, Stacey Lee, a bunch of artists from Houston and Dallas. Should be a lot of fun. Check out our website for info on that. With no further ado, give us a second and we'll be back with Comics Talk for the week. We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, May 27th, the final week of May, which there's a... We thought it was going to be a lighter week, but there's actually a lot of stuff we liked this week.
Yeah, it's the fifth week for books, and usually that means it's a little bit of a lighter one, but... You know, with Secret Wars raging on and the end of Convergence that occurs this week.
A few big releases like Fight Club 2.
Yeah. It's like made for a very it's a notable fifth week.
May has had a lot of good comics.
It really, really has.
So, Dave, why don't you kick off for us?
Right. So, speaking of Fight Club 2.
Yeah.
you know, funny thing about this, I believe this is to be a sequel to the novel, as opposed to the movie, although they're close enough that... you don't have to have read the novel.
Yeah, I think of the three of us, Nick has read the novel.
Yep.
And you and I, Dave, have seen, and I really love the movie.
Yeah.
And this, I didn't have any problem following it. All I was, occasionally I was reading it, and I was like, oh, that's different.
like what?
I don't know, there was stuff, their relationship was a little bit different than I remembered it being. There was some stuff in there that I was like, that's a little different than how he was in the movies.
I you know, I'm actually trying to remember exactly how the movie and book ended, or you know, if there were, I don't know if
there's any similarities, difference. But there's also a little bit of difference.
The movie sort of ended with buildings toppling.
Yeah, the movie is somewhat apocalyptic in a way,
and him with the girl, sort of like it's a crazy Brave New World kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, this picks up what 10 years later.
Yeah.
Yes, 10 years later, and oh, and Nick, I was asking Randy this earlier. What was the name of what I know as Edward Norton's character?
He never had a name.
Okay,
he was just called the narrator, right?
Yeah, I mean,
is that in the book as well?
He gave different names. Like Cornelius was one of the big ones that he gave.
Yeah,
probably sort of a little maybe a cue to the. To the attentive reader that there might be more than meets the eye to his personality.
Yeah, and also I think it was also used for...
He was an everyman.
It could be anybody.
He was sort of the all-purpose stand-in for male ennui of the 90s.
Yep. And of course, his counterpart, Tyler Durden.
Right. So in the comic, 10 years have passed. So he's going by the name of Sebastian in the comic, which is like... they say that's what he calls himself these days. This is a very darkly funny comic. He's what's her character?
Marla.
But they have sort of a troubled life. She basically still wants Tyler Durden, and he's kind of...
She wants the excitement that Tyler brought to
their relationship.
He's
boring in bed.
Yep.
They have some kids. There's some lines in here I can't read because they're dirty.
It is very, very dirty.
And there are, even in the first issue, there is like, I don't want to say there's a big twist, but there is a big reveal, and so I think people who like the Fight Club, you know, they enjoyed the just sort of the purely dramatic twists and turns of the movie and or book, are going to, even in this first issue, get something that'll be like, oh, wow, that was pretty notable. And did you read it, Nick?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I love
talking about
issue.
the sequence that involves the therapist.
Right.
But I don't want to say anything else about it. What was funny is this book had me cracking up at Indecent Humor, which is, you know, what Chuck... How do you say his name?
Chuck... I always said...
Polaniak?
I think Polaniak is right. I think I always said Polaniak, or...
Yeah, I always said Polaniak, but I don't actually know. It's Polaniuk, really, but who knows?
Chuck. My boy Chuck.
Your boy Chuck.
So
he's always been good at sort of the indecent humor and the...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's his thing. So Marla is still attending, like, the... what do you call it? Like, therapy
support
sessions?
Groups.
Support groups for diseases and things she doesn't have.
Yeah.
One of the ones she goes to is for people with, was it, progeria?
Yeah.
Hutchinson-Gilford progeria syndrome.
Yes, the people who look at prematurely old, who are like 9 years old, that look like they're old people. She very clearly doesn't fit in. And as she explains it, well, I have a very mild case.
She says she's like, she looks 50 when she's like 30.
Yeah. Anyway, that is sort of typical of the dark humor of it. Beyond that, there's some interesting sort of formalist experiments. What do you got? Sebastian, our narrator, is sort of self. He's taking a lot of medication, self-medicating with pills and stuff like that. And one of the interesting things that does is when he's kind of fading out of conversations, or they're getting in between him and listening to people, they're literally physically draw sort of the pills on the page as if somebody has. You drop some pills onto the comic page.
Yeah.
Not like they're part of the storyline, but like they are rolling around on your page and they're covering up some of the word balloons and stuff like that, kind of blurring them out for him. There was some really neat stuff like that.
I mean, that's sort of on par with what they did in the movie where they did all
right, there's breaking the fourth wall.
Breaking the fourth wall. There was also random cuts where Brad Pitt's Tyler Durden appears in a flash. It's throughout the entire film. It's not just
those split-second bits. So, Randy, you surmised that might be the very excellent artist, Cameron Stewart.
Yep.
That might be some of his suggestion or doing, and I think that's not a crazy idea.
There's a lot of the strength of this book does come from Cameron Stewart's art is fantastic.
Yeah,
it is.
And is this really feels to me like the kind of book that Vertigo would have done a few years ago.
Yeah, I could see that.
It's a big win for Dark Horse.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Yes, it feels like a legitimate sequel. I don't want to tell you too much because I don't want to give things away.
No.
But suffice to say, their life has fallen into a pathetic place, and Tyler Durden is not quite ready to quit. There are some interesting twists and turns, and it's darkly funny throughout. So I think anybody who liked the movie book, or any of Chuck Palahniuk's stuff, or even just dark story, but funny storyline.
I think I've seen some interviews floating around with Palahniuk or Palahniuk, or whatever you want to say. And him basically saying that he loves comics and the stories that he can tell with that.
I was surprised that he chose it, but I kind of got the impression reading an interview with him a few months ago, that maybe part of the reason he chose it is because the book is its own thing, the movie is kind of has its own following, and he wanted to do something else, sort of a third medium.
That makes sense.
But it has the same...
But I kind of expected him to be awkward at it.
Does not come across that way at all.
Yeah, no, this usually when you get novelists in comics, there's too much prose, or the storytelling doesn't quite work. And part of this, we just surmise that it might be because he's working with Cameron Stewart as an expert storyteller.
But a lot of people who have big books like this... They usually do like a story synopsis and hand it off to another writer.
Yeah.
And that's not the case here. The case here is him actually writing
it. So it's very clearly by the original author.
So, I mean, it's got the same bite. It's not, it doesn't hold anything back. I mean, it is just sort of what you expect from Fight Club.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really good.
So what you guys got?
Nick, what do you got?
I have a Secret Wars title. Shocking.
This will probably be yours and my picks for the next few weeks.
Secret whores.
Hey.
There's no secret.
There's no secret here. No.
Public whores.
Mine is Inhumans Attilan Rising, number one, which has the Battle World logo on, or emblem on it, because it takes place. I think it's one of the key books that sort of connects some of the different worlds together. And this one is sort of about the Inhumans, a group of. Rebels trying to undermine Doom's regime, and
so everybody's been like, I haven't read this one. I know that everybody is sort of locked off in their own separate sort of areas by are they walls?
Yes, there are different gateways essentially that are.
I was just trying to think, how do they keep the heroes from flying around?
Good question.
I guess
there's probably
don't. Well, the Thors do. The Thors keep them in line.
The Thors are sort of their police.
It's probably
force.
One of those things. It's like you could do it, but if you do, you're going to bring a Thor down on you.
Pretty much.
Well, that's what happens in A-Force.
Yeah, and that's what happens here in Inhumans when a group of rebels teleport into Greenland Hulk territory to deliver a serum that actually gives intelligence back to the Hulks because they're all about sort of trying to undermine Doom and will do anything as possible. But it also does the opposite of that, where Medusa is the queen of the Inhumans and sort of set up in New Attilan, which is really, really prominent for Doom for some reason. We have no idea why.
The Inhumans traditionally live in Attilan. What is it in this?
It's part of Doom's territory, basically.
Yeah, okay. But it's some sort of key component.
She seems to be one of his barons. Every domain has its baron, and Medusa seems to be one of the big ones.
And this is to have the traditional Inhuman sort of royal family, which is to say,
yes and no, because
some of them are in the rebellion, right?
Correct. I mean, it's Medusa, and we haven't seen any other like the key people.
Well, Karnak's in there.
Karnak is in there towards the end as part of the rebellion.
Yeah. Don't they mention Gorgon? I think they do.
I don't know if they do.
Maybe
but
not.
The big thing is there's a group of the rebellions that we see, the rebels that we see, named the G-Man, which is sort of this...
He looks like a Ghost Rider.
He is a Ghost Rider.
Yep.
He is called a Spirit of Ignition by the Thors, which I think is fantastic.
They're a variant of, like, Speed Force type stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the... what was it Swamp Thing was a...
Elemental.
He was a plant elemental. Yeah. Firestorm was a fire elemental.
Yeah.
He's a Spirit of Ignition.
Yep.
It sounds fun.
It does. And it's all sort of, you know, this is written by Charles Soule, so he's kind of the guy who has basically the driving force behind all the Inhuman books.
It's kind of weird to think that Matt Fraction was going to be that guy.
Yeah, I know. He dropped off after issue, what, one?
He did the one shot.
He did
and
the
then
one
Charles
shot.
Soule took over
that
and
was sort
building
of a, he and Marvel weren't seeing eye to eye kind of thing, right?
So, Nick, let me ask you this. I know you've read some of the Inhumans. Are these characters that we know, or are they all new?
I believe one or two are ones we've seen. Like, Raja, I believe, has been around.
Okay, because I read this, I didn't know who anybody was.
Well, there's a Hulk that is sort of has his intelligence. He's part of the group.
Yeah.
There's the Ghost Rider, who is very much the 1940s, or mobster, has a Tommy gun. It's very cool.
But it didn't feel like something where you had to have read Inhumans.
No. This is very... You could start right here.
I have read of the various different Secret Wars, none of them have really required a lot of past knowledge from the reader. You could jump in on any title that sort of captures your fancy.
Well, that's what I kind of like about Secret Wars is it's clear that, you know, they always do these editorial meetings where they get a bunch of their writers in and they come up with stuff and then they go out and hand it out to everybody. And sometimes they just feel really disparate and disconnected from each other. Secret Wars, I feel like they're really doing world building. Like, I feel like they plotted out the geography.
Yeah.
They figured out the rules of this world. And so you see little things like Greenland popping up in a couple of different books. Or in MODOK this week, there's some crossover between the different territories.
Yep.
I like that they're sort of acknowledging this as a bunch of worlds. Each story stands alone, but you definitely get a sense of a larger world.
Yeah. And I also like that they're allowing sort of different versions of characters to exist.
Yeah.
Especially because it reminds me a lot of DC's Elseworlds, where you've got great, like, Texas Ranger or Western versions of the characters.
Yeah.
We actually get sort of an Inhuman that's Matt Murdock.
That's right. Yeah.
As sort of a minstrel. I mean, not a minstrel, but a bard, essentially.
Yeah.
He's very cool.
But the coolest thing is not until the tail end.
Well, the driving force of this book is that Doom tasks Medusa with finding the rebels.
Yeah.
And that leads to a certain place called the Quiet Room.
Yeah.
And
which is sort of like, without giving away too much, it's like the Casablanca.
It's Casablanca. And it's very, very cool. I thought the art, which is by
Casablanca in what sense?
It's a bar where everybody goes, and there are people with different factions working there, but it's sort of a neutral zone.
Oh, yeah, it's a neutral
zone.
So everybody from all the different worlds.
Yeah, it seems like the different territories kind of cross over there.
Yeah. Does Doom know about it?
I don't know. I don't get the sense that maybe he... Well, yeah, because
he
tells Medusa about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
seems like it'd be hard for him to not know about that.
Yeah. And I loved the art. It was very Ryan Stegman-esque, but this is drawn by John Timms, which I'm not familiar
with.
Yeah,
it's pretty nice art.
It is very, very, very nice. And I don't know. I just really love it. I think I'm on a high of all things Secret Wars. So,
Speaking of which,
so far I'm also very much into Secret Wars, and my pick this week was Infinity Gauntlet number one, which I am not the hugest fan of the original Infinity Gauntlet story. I like it, but I didn't love it.
I love Star Wars.
This is like the only Secret Wars thing I've read this week, and I will say it bears no resemblance to.
No, it's not. It's clearly in a post Infinity Gauntlet world where Thanos had his, big epic thing, but it feels almost more like the Annihilation Wave.
Yeah.
Because it's an Earth that's been sort of overrun with alien bugs.
And yet, at its heart, it's not even that. It doesn't feel like the Annihilation books did.
Well, no, but it's set in a world where the Annihilation Wave hit Earth.
Right.
And there's sort of alien bugs. The world is very post-apocalyptic. And it's about this family, granddad, a father, and a daughter. And their mom disappeared to join the Nova Corps. And they all assume that she's dead. That she died fighting Space Wars.
Yeah.
And it's sort of how they're trying to survive in this wrecked world where the bugs are all around them. And they've got a dog with their dog is with them named Zigzag. And it's got stunning artwork by Dustin Weaver. Just really nice.
I really thought, the driving force is sort of the connectivity and the of all this family.
What struck me as I was reading it? Is how infrequently I have seen, this is an African-American family.
Yeah.
And how infrequently I see that, just as sort of like, you will often see in these kind of comics about survivors in a wasteland or whatever, you'll often see family units and stuff like that. It's pretty rare. You realize how kind of white bread they have been.
Yeah. But sort of, I think one of the girls can like draw, and there's kind of touching scene with her like drawing the face of her mother.
Yep. It's written by Jerry Duggan, who has done Deadpool, and I feel like just some other big stuff he's done.
He's been writing Nova for a while.
Nova, yeah. And, I have not been reading a lot of the cosmic books. I haven't read much of Dugan's Nova, but this is a great, great book. And there's some Infinity Stone stuff going on, so they're obviously building to something bigger. But if you go in expecting sort of Thanos destroying, the big Thanos cosmic thing, this is not that at first. It is starting on a very, very small family level. I'm a sucker for post-apocalypse. This feels a lot like sort of Walking Dead, sort of trying to survive without all the darkness.
What was that video game that was apocalyptic with a maybe dead?
Last of Us? Yeah, something like that.
Randy, you mentioned that art, and the art was incredible.
Yeah, it's some of the best art I've seen. Really, really nice.
And honestly, even if somebody thinks this premise doesn't sound interesting to me, I'd recommend taking a look at it just for that art.
Yeah. No, this was a really, really good read. I really liked it, and I was not expecting to like as much as I did. My cheater pick for the week is another Secret Wars book called MODOK Assassin, written by Chris Yost, art by Amilcar Pina, sure. New artist to me. I don't know him. Really nice. I like it a lot. And it's basically a point-of-view book for MODOK, the mental organism designed only for killing, the giant baby head in a floating chair.
First person.
He takes on Bullseye. He deals with the Baron of his Killville, which is Baron Mordo.
Uh-huh.
Killville is a place where only the villains exist. They've killed all the heroes, so it is all the villains sort of fighting it out. And he goes through what they're bordered by. So they're bordered by the Monarchy of M, which is House of M. They're bordered by the Sentinels' territory. They're bordered by the World of 2099, and he interacts with all these people. There's all this crossover between these different worlds. It's really good, and it's got a sort of sense of humor. MODOK is often played for laughs, but it's played pretty straight.
I mean, he is a mental organism designed for killing.
He's a bad man.
Yes, he is.
He does his damage. He's not afraid of anybody, and there are people afraid of him, and robots afraid of him. So definitely worth a look on MODOK Assassin. I really like this. Nick, what is your cheater pick for the week?
My cheater pick is another Secret Wars book, which is Inferno, number one.
That was good, too.
Which is a spinning off of the old... We were trying to figure out... Remember, was this late 80s or early 90s?
It was early 90s.
Was it early 90s?
Yeah.
Basically, dealing with Blasco and Limbo popping up in Manhattan.
Demons taking over Manhattan.
Demons taking over Manhattan. And basically, this was... What if they won?
Yeah, there's a... The X-Men have their sort of headquarters outside the Inferno, which they keep contained within this wall. And Colossus, every year, leads a team in to try and rescue his sister, Ilyana, who's at the center of it.
Exactly. And it was an interesting premise. This is written by Dennis Hopeless, so Avengers Arena and all those other fun stuff. Art by Javier Garon, which I thought the art was really nice.
Yeah, it's nice.
But I actually have a lot of fondness for the old Inferno story. It's, Madeline Pryor and all the crazy stuff.
Yep.
And I got to see Arctic Attack Cyclops, which is Cyclops.
Your favorite costume?
My favorite costume, the old X-Factor costume. But I actually just thought...
Also, I like Colossus. I'm a big Colossus fan, and he's not been written well in a long time. And I thought this was a really great take on Colossus.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. I thought Dennis Hopeless has a really good handle on who these characters are.
Yep.
And you know, we also get people like Domino, and yeah. seeing Domino and Colossus' relationship
that was interesting.
Was really yeah. interesting.
And also Nightcrawler, he's a bit player of sorts, but yep. he's done well. So basically, you put Colossus and Nightcrawler together, you got my interest, because that's two of my favorite X-Men.
Yeah. And I think anybody who is a fan of the X-Men, or just a fan of Inferno, I think this is one of those books that you're going to want to check out, not only for just a fun story, but great art, and seeing the characters... sort of that we know and love.
Yeah, I haven't read X-Men in a while, just I'm not a big Bendis fan, and I haven't liked a lot of the X-Men stuff in the past, I don't know, 5-10 years. This was X-Men stuff I liked, which was kind of nice.
Well, yeah, so take a look at this one.
Yeah, I think you would like it, David. It also has Boom Boom, who I know you have a fondness for. Or is that an ironic fondness?
She's called Boomer. I'm neutral on Boom Boom. She was in the X Factor early issues
there's,
I read.
There's always
I don't like to see her like get messed up or anything. If she's done well, then that would probably be cool.
She was done well here.
Like many of these Secret Wars books, there's a few surprises here and there. Yeah. And there's a cool twist towards the end of this one.
Yeah.
You know, Boom Boom was like the proto Jubilee.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yep. What's your cheater pick?
I have like three cheater picks, but the one that's on top...
I mean, I have cheater.
We all do. ...is the second issue of the Convergent Shazam, which came to... brought this to a finale that I enjoyed quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
In this this one, this has the, you know, very golden age, upbeat Shazam interacting with the world of Gotham by Gaslight, the steampunk Batman where he...
Dark
Jack
future.
...the Ripper and stuff, yeah. But it's also... It never goes too much to those dark places in this one. The Shazam spirit sort of dominates it.
Yeah.
And his, you know, the Batman's Gaslight world has been sort of taken over and invaded by one of Captain Marvel's big foes. So again, it feels more Captain Marvel than anything else. One kind of neat thing is there's a page here that shows all the sort of steampunk era villains. So you see the Joker, Jack the Ripper, which is from first Gotham by Gaslight.
Yeah.
But there's also a version of Harley Quinn, Clayface, Mr. Freeze, Two-Face. They're just as sort of background villains. They don't get a ton of screen time, but it was still fun to see.
That panel was one of my favorite in the issue, was that little alternate world villain.
No, it definitely does not go too dark.
It doesn't go too dark, doesn't surprise me. No. Jeff Parker, sort of, that's his kind of thing.
And of course I really like the art by Evan Shaner. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're either kind of already on board this or not, but it gets a good conclusion.
This week is the end of Convergence, the final issue of the Convergence main series, and then all the number twos finish up this week. So we still have a few of those. If anyone was looking for any of them, we do have those on the shelf, and the whole series is wrapped, and the DC sort of relaunch of sorts will hit next week, right?
I believe so.
And just sort of in flipping through it, it does seem like there's sort of... We'll have to see how it all plays out, but there's sort of a big reveal in Convergence, which has also, in some ways, been touched on by another DC book a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I don't want to spoil anything.
No.
But it could potentially lead to stuff that I am interested in, so I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Dave, what else is on your stack?
In the stack, the sort of notable ones for me are first issue of Alan Moore's Providence. That's his third Lovecraftian story.
Yep.
It's a prequel to Neonomicon.
Yeah,
right?
although it feels pretty standalone.
Yes, it's completely standalone.
Yeah.
I mean, since it's set decades before, it seems like.
Yeah.
And follows a journalist sort of investigating things that may lead to Lovecraftian things. But it's kind of a quiet conversational issue. It's mostly his interview with somebody and some backstory.
Well, they overtly reference The King in Yellow.
Yeah.
Which is a big old...
And a few other mystical tomes, you know. They seem to be talking around the Necronomicon. I don't think they drop the name in there.
No, they don't.
But they mentioned a few other ones, and I suspect it's building to that.
Weirdly, I would suggest to people, there were a lot of people who were disappointed in season one of True Detective because they teased King in Yellow stuff. But they didn't sort of commit to it.
Right.
And I believe this is going to commit to it more. So if you were one of those hoping the True Detective was going to go more of an occult direction, I believe this might be the book for you.
Right. I also have the third issue of Sabrina, which sort of follows her. It's like her witch coming out party. She is turning 16, and it's time for her to undergo her rites. And the was it Madame Satan or whatever?
Yeah.
The previous issue is manipulating events. There is some dark and messed up stuff in this. It was another really good issue. Like, a lot happens in these. I guess I can somewhat understand why they were late.
I'm curious, Dave, if you had to rank Sabrina versus Afterlife with Archie, do you like either one better? Or?
I think I like Afterlife with Archie just a touch more because I like the sort of the whole Archie gang.
Yeah, yeah.
But Sabrina, in some ways, I think is like maybe better written. The focus makes it a little bit.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Is that I might like Afterlife with Archie a little bit better, but Sabrina seems more focused. Is the word?
Yeah, it's really good.
It is really good,
and sometimes shockingly dark.
Yeah.
There's a few books I haven't read yet. Some new Image books. I really don't know a lot about them. One is called Material, and one is Sons of the Devil, which at the very least looked like it had some fairly amazing art from Tony Infante.
Yep. The art looked good on that one.
And then I've got to, let's see, that's some of the Secret War stuff. Two graphic novels here, or trade paperbacks this week. The collection of Edward Scissorhands from Kate Leth.
Yeah.
Which I'd been enjoying the early issues of, but I lost track of somewhere, so I'll probably give this a read.
Yep.
And then the second volume of Batman Adventures, which is the 90s comics that were spun off of the animated, the legendary Batman animated series.
Some of the best Batman comics ever done.
They're fantastic. They're really good. I own all of those in single issues.
Me too.
But I'll probably be buying this in collected format just to have some nice collections up on the bookshelf.
Yep. Nick, what's on your stack?
I only have two other books that I'm going to mention.
Okay.
Both Secret Wars tie-ins. The first one being Old Man Logan, which sees the continuation of the mega hit that Mark Millar did, at this point, 5 years ago?
Yeah, who was Steve McNiven the artist?
Steve McNiven doing the art. This is Brian Michael Bendis and artist Andrea Sorrentino.
Who we think was on Green Arrow?
I believe he was on Green Arrow, and Brian Michael Bendis is on everything.
Yeah.
And sort of, I really enjoyed it, and I actually do not care for the original story, but I like the concept of sort of the pacifist Wolverine unsheathing his claws, sort of. I mean, it's the
it's a riff on Unforgiven.
Unforgiven,
yeah.
And
yeah.
I like the notion of that. Yeah. And
he's not necessarily so much a pacifist. Well, I mean, I guess he is. But he's just sort of like, I'm done with this. I'm going to go be a farmer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he said he would not, fight another person because essentially, in
he's just not like a hippie activist.
Well,
pacifist.
Well, in the original story, I mean, he kills all of his friends. He kills the X-Men.
Right.
And he says he will never, do that stuff again. I liked where they went with this in the story, and there were some cool guest stars. And then the other one is the Secret Wars Journal number one.
Which is the second of the anthology books they're doing.
Yes. And this one has a story that has Lady Hawkeye.
And sort of the Young Avengers, but in 1603 Marvel.
Yeah, which I thought was a really cool spin.
Sort of a Robin Hood type thing.
And then the second story, which I thought was almost maybe even cooler.
That was the best story in the two, yeah.
Which focuses on a group of X-Men.
Yeah.
In sort of Egypt. Or in the world.
It's the world where Egypt rules the world, yeah.
Yes. And as you might guess, there might be a Moon Knight influence in there as well.
Yep.
And the story is just really, really fun and beautifully drawn by... who was Luca Pizzati, which I do not know.
Well, the take on... They use Khonshu in Egyptia, which I believe was not in the original New Warriors storyline that created this book. But the Khonshu is sort of the goddess overseeing the whole thing or something.
Yeah.
And people are very much doubtful of her as a goddess. And it's interesting. And it was a really good story.
Why is there... I'm trying to figure out, why is there an entire world devoted to... Or, portion of the battle world devoted to Egypt, ancient Egypt.
I thought that was an interesting one, too, because it's sort of an obscure one. I'm glad they did it, because I really liked that story.
There are, lots of sort of references you can find, from Rama Tut to Apocalypse.
And I believe that's why.
Yeah. And that sort of makes sense. I mean, it seems like a kind of fun world to play around with.
But these sort of, the journal and what's the other one?
Battle World.
They're just exploring kind of fun concepts.
Yeah. Shorter stories, 10 pages of little things. And some of them tie in, I think they mentioned that the Kate Bishop story is going to continue into Witch Hunter Angela.
Right.
And some of them are just end, and they're just little short stories. So
a reference, in Battleworld, an old What-If story.
Yeah. It's a good bit of flavor for the Battleworld stuff, and so far I'm definitely not at the point where I'm like, oh, I'm tired of all this. I'm looking for more, so I'm enjoying it.
I'm at this point, and it's a little early. I'm probably going to buy most of this when it's collected.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that same point right now. They are right now very much on the tip of my interest.
I just think they're getting really great artists and a lot of unknowns, and I'm just loving it.
So what were there, 7 Secret Wars books this week?
Eight.
There are 8 Secret Wars books this week. And so, the other two are on my reading stack.
Uh-huh.
Secret Wars 2099 number 1, which for the first time introduces the Avengers of 2099, which it's on page 3, so I'm going to reveal the team. It contains a new Falcon. It contains an Iron Man. It contains a female Captain America and Hercules.
Yep.
Classic Hercules, who is, of course, immortal, so it makes sense that he would still be in there.
I was flipping through that, and I was happy to see old school Hercules.
And it's written by Peter David, who's a guy who can definitely write Hercules and have fun with it.
And who knows his way around 2099.
Will Sliney is the artist, and he's a guy who's been doing some of Spider-Man 2099 stuff. It gets into sort of the mega corporate ruled world of 2099.
Yep.
Deals Alchemist. With sort of the the backstory of some of the characters who are actually the new Avengers.
Huh?
I really liked this. And here's the thing. There's some things in here that look like things have moved forward from the Spider-Man world.
Yep.
I won't reveal, but there's some stuff with who's in charge of the corporation, that kind of thing.
And I was very happy with... I mean, Peter David's take on Hercules is great.
Yeah.
And the sort of backstory that he gives him is pretty remarkable. And,
yeah.
I was a big fan of this as well.
Yeah, I really liked it. And then finally, there's the weirdest Secret Wars book I think we've seen so far. Which is Where Monsters Dwell, number one.
Yeah.
This is by Garth Ennis. Stars the Phantom Eagle, who is basically one of Marvel's obscure biplane characters. And he's a scoundrel.
Like World War One aces.
Yeah. He's a scoundrel. He leaves a native girl pregnant after telling her he's going to marry her in the first two pages.
Very Garth Ennis. Person.
And then he meets up with a woman who wants him to fly her somewhere. And they wind up at a place with dinosaurs.
Yeah.
So it's World War One biplane versus dinosaurs with some super science mixed in the... It's very sort of pulpy. Now,
are they still in a walled-off section, essentially?
I think they flew over one of the walls.
Okay.
Yeah.
They have an Indiana Jones-style map at the end. They put the whole battle world, and then they show here's where they traveled. And cross from the Far East into the Valley of the Flame.
So there are people traversing through a lot of these things.
Yeah.
And I think in Secret Wars 2, they did say that if a Baron allows you, he can let you go through different worlds.
Yes.
Yeah. You just don't want to go to
We haven't yet figured out exactly what Doom's intent is in sort of having this fiefdom.
No.
Yeah. Well, I think he probably is pretty happy to rule the world.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
There's also a new issue of S.H.I.E.L.D. number 6, which I think starts a new story arc. It's sort of a continuation of what they've been doing, but where they had been doing a lot of single-issue stories, this sort of reveals that there's been an ongoing thread, a mystical thread, introduces a new mystical S.H.I.E.L.D. agent, which was great.
Yeah, there was a bit in there that made me laugh out loud, and people see what I'm talking about.
Right? Uses some characters that he had in Daredevil. I remember thinking they were weird when they showed up there, but I liked the way he did them. He uses them here very well. There's a big Doctor Strange big bad in here. Really nice art from Paul Renaud. And I'm really liking this book, and I continue to really enjoy this. This has Coulson and May out in action. And there's a really clever – there's a sort of a mystical virus, and there's a really clever reason that it works the way it does and why they have to – choose the allies they do. I really like this book. It's definitely not I'm not as big on the S.H.I.E.L.D. show as we have mentioned before, but I love this book.
Nick shakes his head.
I know. Wayward number 8, which is the latest in Jim Zub and Stephen Cummings' Japanese Teenagers versus Monsters book, which I continue to really enjoy. And the finale of the Ultron Forever storyline. This is the Uncanny Avengers Ultron Forever one-shot. It was three issues, all by the same creative team, all Alan Davis and Al Ewing writing, and it reveals the identity of the Doctor Doom who put them all together. It features the Avengers versus a ton of Ultrons, and it's a pretty fun conclusion.
I need to read that. I forgot that came out this week. They did do that weird format where each one is a different Avengers book
that
has that Ultron Forever logo banner across it.
Yeah.
So that one had slipped under my radar.
All right, that'll about wrap it up for comics for us this week. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about some TV, like the Supergirl pilot, some movies, and some board games. All right, so I don't know if you guys have been on the internet at all.
I peruse it occasionally.
But apparently there's this Supergirl show that's coming out. And apparently...
I heard it's basically the SNL spoof.
Yeah, that's what I heard, too.
Yeah, I think there were 6 minutes shown, and then people freaked their...
people freaked out, yeah. And a lot of people were... I think we talked about the trailer.
We talked about it last week.
And we pretty much liked it.
We have more to say this week.
Well, yeah. It turns out that people were a little... There was a little bad buzz building off that trailer. And
there was also good buzz.
There was some good, but I saw a lot of backlash.
Yeah, most of what I saw was bad.
Yeah, there was a lot of backlash.
A few of our friends.
Our circle
was almost half and half.
Our circle of friends. We've curated our circle of friends a little bit, so we weren't seeing. I think the mainstream may have been a bad backlash.
Really, I was under more than the impression that it was our circle of friends that were backlashing.
I don't know. At any rate, it might have made CBS nervous, and they might have released the pilot online without claiming responsibility.
It's quite possible.
That is the current narrative going on. At any rate, the pilot's out there, and we've all seen it.
That's true. We did.
So we're going to start off with a slightly spoilery. We probably won't spoil everything, but we'll probably be spoilery.
We can keep the big stuff away, sort of.
But so if you don't want to hear it, skip ahead a little bit. We're going to talk about Tomorrowland, Sons of Anarchy, a couple board games. But we're going to start off with a slightly spoilery review of the Supergirl pilot.
You know what I noticed? That little six-minute trailer actually showed quite a bit. It showed, like, sort of like the ending scene is in there. Now, they left out a big chunk of the
spoiler
action and what the deal is. I didn't say what it is.
I think they left out a fair amount. And I do think a lot of the sort of the romance-y stuff that people didn't like is in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah. Well, let's start off. What did you guys think of it? I mean, just general.
I really liked it. I thought it was as strong as the Flash pilot.
I agree.
I don't think it was as strong as Flash pilot. Y'all are a little bit crazy, but it was good.
Yeah, but I think the weird thing is, I think the trailer was a pretty good representation of what it's going to be. But I've seen a lot of people who didn't like the trailer saying that they've seen the pilot and now they like the show.
Well, that's what I think. What CBS is banking on. I mean, it is a really good show, and I think people are kind of coming around after seeing it.
Does seem to be the case. You know, a lot of people mentioned that on that trailer that sort of rom-com music that they had going on in the background kind of really created these expectations, and it made it look like it was just literally snipping pieces from romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And, you know, following all their cliches. The music is not present in the show.
Yeah.
It has music. It's not that music.
And also, I don't think this is a rom-com. There's her buddy, who's basically her Cisco, who obviously has an unrequited crush.
Yeah.
And there's James Olsen, who she thinks it's cute, but I don't think it's supposed to be a romantic thing with them.
I felt like she was just utterly, like, bewildered by his good looks and stuff.
Did you? Because
she was stammering and everything. That's like the movie cliche for...
It was a very Sorkin-esque sort of...
Oh, that's not a good thing.
Well, I mean, it can come off nicely. I mean, in a good way, too.
That's weird. I didn't read that as romantic. Now, maybe that's where they're going.
I 100% did.
I read that honestly like a gender... I read that as Wells. He was her mentor. That's how I read that.
Yeah, no, I think it was sort of, you know, he's very confident and sort of, and handsome and everything like that. And I think she might have been both starstruck and also like, and this guy is really handsome. But there was like, I felt that there was sort of...
Is there any point at which she says something like how good looking he is or anything? Really?
Yes.
Okay, I just missed it.
Yeah, I also felt like sort of the way the camera lingered on his kind of smile and stuff.
But I think by the end of the episode, that dynamic is completely changed.
Sure. It is not what it looked to be, where it is all about that. I feel like there might be a little bit more of the sort of romantic element. Not that there wasn't in Flash either.
Here's what I'll say about the romantic element of Supergirl. It's handled better than the romantic element in Flash.
Yeah, agreed. I didn't think... I don't get a sense of a will they won't they with James Olsen and Supergirl and Kara. I think that they are Kara. Sorry,
it's Kara.
Kara. They make a joke about that. The people call her Kara and she doesn't like it.
You know, you mentioned that, by the way. Well, we'll finish your thought. Sorry.
I don't get a will they won't they from James Olsen and Kara. I get a mentor, a guy who knows her cousin really well, who is going to be sort of her sounding board for more experienced superhero stuff.
I get a will they won't they.
We'll see.
And I'm more on Rainey's
camp. I think you're right that'll be part of it, though.
But I think the big thing that they put out there is Superman. I mean, he is front and center in this.
We did catch some of that even from the trailer, but yeah, it essentially begins on Krypton.
Do you guys get... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it moves very quickly through it, though. It's not like you're going to get a ton of origin time. In fact, you're going to get superhero action and costume stuff like within the first 10 to 15 minutes.
Yep.
It moves along briskly and... But nobody is going to be bored by this. No guy, like, say, watching it who's like, this is a girl show.
Yeah, no, it's not
like
that.
Some 13-year-old kid.
I think what surprised me more than anything is a lot of these shows sort of try to shy away from, like, let's not mention Superman or Batman or Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And they're very much like, no, it's my cousin. I was there to, you know, do this. That didn't happen, so...
Do we want to just quick say what the premise is that they mentioned?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is in the trailer, too. The DEO, which is the Department of Extra-Normal Operations...
Well, I didn't mean that, actually. I meant why she came to Earth.
Oh, yeah. Well, that she came... She was supposed to be his protector.
Yeah.
Right.
And she got stuck
In the Phantom Zone.
In the Phantom Zone.
Which I didn't know it was the Phantom Zone that was going to be part
of it. I thought it was kind of cool.
I wanted to mention, it's obviously not the Man of Steel take on Superman, because Metropolis being destroyed would be a different... Correct. He would not be as beloved as he is in this world. But the Phantom Zone criminals and the prison ship, that's from the Man of Steel movie. The costume looks like Man of Steel, so it feels like they're nodding at the Man of Steel without acknowledging
it. Sort of the way Batman the Animated Series in the 90s nodded to the Tim Burton movies?
Yeah, I think so.
Design work and Danny Elfman's music and stuff.
Yeah, but that it's not in continuity with it.
Right. In fact, it was much better, just as this looks to be much better than Man of Steel.
Yes, yep.
But yeah, she was supposed to be his protector, but got delayed.
Because she was already 13,
I guess. She would have actually been older than him, but because of the delay in the Phantom Zone...
She got stuck in the Phantom Zone for 24 years.
Yep. Right.
So when she comes to Earth, he's already in his 20s. He's already Superman.
Right.
He doesn't need her protection.
Right. Helps her find a family, and she doesn't end up using her powers, other than she knows she has them, but she doesn't really use them in her life, and she's been sort of aimless and trying to figure out what to do with her life, which I think, her not knowing, not using her powers and stuff like that, it's a nice little metaphor.
Yeah.
For that sort of... I don't know what to do with my life that a lot of people in their 20s find.
Yep.
Which I think it's going to resonate with them beyond just the sort of action-adventure elements of the show.
Yeah, I agree.
I actually think she's great as Supergirl.
Oh, yeah. Melissa Benoist is fantastic.
A lot of the cast, I'm like, I recognize you,
but
I can't place you, and you're all really good at what you're doing.
I had a feeling she was probably going to... I haven't seen her in anything before, but I noticed too many comments from people... that, were kind of skeptical about her because she wasn't bombshell enough.
Yeah.
They wanted, a super sexy Britney Spears Supergirl. Yeah. And I'm like, are you just looking for wank material?
You know what was awesome is when they do the costume sequence, there are some nods. She has, the 70s Supergirl headband. And then she comes out and,
she's got, the short shorts on.
No, because then she comes out in the Michael Turner look.
Yeah.
With they do both. They nod in the 70s. And she's like, I wouldn't even I wouldn't even sleep in this.
Yeah.
So there's a couple nods of the classic costumes, but they do a great version of the costume.
Yep.
They've got her.
Fantastic.
I don't remember what the guy's name is at the what's it?
The DEO?
That's the planet. What's the name of the paper?
It's Cat Tribune.
It's Cat World or something like that.
It's Catco.
Catco.
Right.
But they have a newspaper.
I thought it was the Tribune.
It's something like that. But they use National City as the name. Yeah, it's not a fictional DC city. I think this is an original one. I don't think National City is a thing.
I don't think so either.
If it is, it's an obscure one, and I don't know.
They mention the Daily Planet.
Yes.
They mentioned the existence of Metropolis, all that kind of stuff. But her buddy at the newspaper, who is sort of has the unrequited crush on her, he is very much their Cisco. I think he's, he helps sort of design the costume. Yes. He's sort of into the superhero thing.
And he's got a little side fascination with aliens and weird news and stuff like that. And that's, of course, plays into the central premise with the DEO.
Yeah. Which is that she basically, when she crashed, the prison ship showed up, and it wasn't just Kryptonians, it was the worst space riffraff, so basically when she came, all the space aliens got unleashed on Earth, and they're sort of gathering it together. There's a tie into that.
I really like this, by the way, as their arc.
Oh, it's a great great way to provide her with bad guys.
Which leads to the action.
Yeah.
Just like
Flash had the metahuman wave that gave him his bad guys, it's the same thing. Her origin provides the bad guys, too.
What I like about that is... it's always kind of a pain when they do a Superman movie and he's the only superhero in the world. So unless you've got the Phantom Zone criminals, he's just got to stop a lot of things, be fast, stop bombs, stop earthquakes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's nice to have some guys who can go toe-to-toe with them and they're just right out of the gate, they have villains.
Well, and their initial bad guy was good. There's a lot of villain.
Yeah.
It's an obscure DC villain. He's a definitely different take for the TV show.
Yeah, but a good one.
But a good one. I liked that. There's a very big Easter egg that maybe hints the direction with the DEO director's name, but I won't mention that one here. That's a spoiler.
I'll tell
you after.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I gotta say, Nick, you mentioned the action, and the action scenes are good. They're
the special effects are great.
What I liked is that they're tough fights, but they still felt like sort of superhero fights. They're not they're not bloody or anything.
Right.
But they're laying down some serious punches. There's no kind of lighter weight stuff because she's a woman or anything like that.
There's collateral damage, but it's not like people being murdered collateral damage like Man of Steel.
Correct.
It's more like stuff gets knocked around.
And I kind of liked that right out of the gate, she's not the greatest superhero. Right. She's got the power, and you see her do that. You see her save a ton of people, which I thought was fantastic.
She has to learn how to fight.
But she hasn't learned how to fight, and I actually really like seeing that. But her sort of trying to overcome that and you know, still winning.
It's a little reminiscent, by the way. They had, and it's a different sort of thing, but Flash wasn't like 100% a master of his powers.
I mean, no.
He's been growing throughout the whole season.
That's the perfect way to do it.
And it does work. It's a good format.
The special effects, though, her heat vision's great.
Yeah. Yep.
Her flight effects are really good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The opening scene that, you know, was glimpsed in the trailer where she deals with a crashing plane, I thought mm-hmm. was really good.
Yep.
I liked the balance it struck between, like, sort of the struggle she had to do it, but, you know, like, what was the Superman movie, Superman Returns, from, like, the early 2000s?
Yeah.
He was, like, saving that plane for, like, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And it was, like, the hardest thing he'd ever had to do.
Yep.
This is, like, a 2 or 3 minute action yeah. sequence.
And it's not perfect because there's a little humor in there.
Right. And it's, but she struggles, and yet it had that superhero vibe to it.
Yeah.
That's what I liked about it.
Yep. And it gets moving. I've seen people complain, people who've seen the pilot, that, it comes across a little bit of, some people said they felt that James Olsen was like, she couldn't do anything until a man told her she could do it. And I think that's a weird reading of it.
Yeah. If you look for sort of everything to be an allegory of
yeah.
something,
yeah.
You run into the same problem that we had with the Black Widow kind of backlash
yeah.
after the Avengers 2, which is everybody needs her to be the symbol for their particular cause.
Right.
And there is a problem in that there's, you know, only one Black Widow. There's only one big female superhero character in movies.
Right.
So she's bearing too much weight, and it's simply unfair. Right now we have sort of what's going to be the first major female superhero on TV.
Yeah.
And so she's probably going to get a lot of weight on her, too. And I thought they did a good job in the
yeah.
first issue, first episode, and that overanalyzing it for that kind of stuff is a little crazy.
Yeah,
I balanced
agree.
All the elements really, really well. And I think the underlying fun and humor that the show has is right what I want.
Yeah, I'm very happy with this. I'm very much looking forward to seeing more of it.
I will say, on a slightly more critical level, I thought some of the dialogue was a little iffy. I didn't think it was quite as strong as Flash, even though Flash occasionally has some dialogue stumbles too. And I thought the plot sometimes moved along a little bit mechanically, or like felt a little like, well, let's get through the DEO exposition quick. I thought a few of the characters were a little simple to start with.
I think if you went back and watched the Flash pilot, you'd see that in the Flash too.
Maybe so.
It's a nature of pilots that there's a lot of exposition to get under. There's
a
lot
of
story arcs.
Didn't seem like a great character to me to start with.
Oh, okay. I liked him, and I liked that actor. I don't know where I know him from, but I liked him. And like I say, he's an Easter egg of sorts. So
okay, yeah, we'll have to talk about that. But I did like the basic lineup of the workings of the DEO. I like her kind of tentative friendship with them and everything.
Yeah, me too.
That's going to clearly be an uneasy alliance the whole time.
Here's the my last question is, are you guys going to watch it? Are you going to set your DVR to record?
Oh, of course, yeah.
And I know you sought out The Flash pretty much every week. There were a couple
yep.
of times, Dave, where you were a little bit behind, but
that's
the nature of
that's just the nature of things, yeah. I will definitely watch like the first few episodes of this. I'm not sure if it'll hold me the way Flash did. You know, mm-hmm. I don't watch Arrow either. I kind
right.
of have slowly caught up on that. So we'll have to see. Flash was definitely something sort of special.
Yeah.
Cool. But I
all
do
right.
think this is much closer to Flash than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Nick and I saw Tomorrowland on
yeah.
Sunday. And
Brad Bird helmed.
Yeah.
George Clooney, and then several actresses and actors that you recognize.
Yeah.
But I can't remember their names at the moment.
I liked it.
Yeah, I quite liked it as well.
It seems like there's a little bit of division I've seen among people on this.
Yeah, I think it's a 50-50 split. It might be sort of that either like it or you hate it.
Now, can y'all, like, I know part of the thing was, like, there wasn't a ton to go on in the early trailers as to what this was going to be about. Can y'all say without blowing too much what it is about?
I don't
particularly mind spoilers.
No, I don't want to give too much away. What else?
Because a lot of this is a sort of the spectacle, the sort of
yeah.
sitting down and kind of getting entrenched in the story or the visuals.
What I'll say I liked about Tomorrowland is it is about hope. It's about sort of
yeah.
the nature of it sort of the central conflict is between sort of post-apocalyptic sci-fi and sort of more hopeful retrofuturism.
Yep.
And
yeah.
it's interesting
Star
that it came
Trek
out
versus Terminator.
It's interesting that it came
yeah,
out
pretty good.
Right after Mad Max has made such a splash.
Right.
Because in a way, it's a mirror image of Mad Max, and that Mad Max is about sort of a dark future,
right.
and Tomorrowland is about sort of a hopeful future, except that Mad Max is also about hope in a dark future.
Right.
But it's sort of like...
So here's the question, is Tomorrowland, does it seem naive?
No. It seems heavy-handed.
Okay.
I think that's why it's getting some of the negative buzz. It is if you don't buy into its message, if you're definitely in a cynical mood,
yeah.
You're going to be rolling your eyes at this movie.
Yeah, I gotcha. One of those ones where if you check out early on, you're just going to listing complaints.
What's funny is I think the moment it started, I was kind of visually just, you know, engaged by it. I was into it, I mean, from the get-go.
Yeah.
And I love sort of the, like you said, retro-futurism.
Yeah.
I'm sucked for George Clooney. It had great humor.
I liked it. I wouldn't say I loved it. It's the first movie of the summer that I don't necessarily need to see again, although I do kind of want my daughter to see it because it is kind of a cool movie. It's the first movie of the summer I'm not sure I'll wind up buying.
I could be persuaded if it's got some cool extra features.
But I also, my bar was set pretty high because Brad Bird did Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which is my favorite of the Mission Impossible. Mm-hmm. Was one of the best action movies of the past decade. And this, I thought, did not reach those levels. It was a good movie, but I thought it had some problems. It's a little long.
Yeah.
Does occasionally slow down a little bit. I also thought, unfortunately, some of the CGI was very CGI. Like, there was some stuff where I was dropped out a bit because I was like, okay, none of that is real.
There was a... was it Cracked or whatever that did that article that I posted a week or two back?
Yeah, about the CGI.
Like, 5 reasons why modern CG looks like crap or something like that. And it was a pretty good overview of why our sort of brains reject some of what, you know, you think that, you know, Jurassic Park looked so good in 1993. You know, it should look just utterly amazing now. And yet sometimes it still looks kind of crappy.
Yeah.
And this was a good overview of why. And there are pitfalls.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sometimes they just get too showy with it.
But overall, I thought it was really good. George Clooney's really good. The lead girls who are both, according to your wife, Disney kids. They've been in Disney shows. Right. I didn't know either one of them, but they were both really good. It's a lot of fun. It's got a really cool message. And I would say that... I understand why some people don't like it. I understand why it's sort of very mixed reviews, but I definitely put myself in the liked it camp.
Yeah, I would recommend people go and see it. I mean, I think it's fun.
Dave, you've been watching Sons of Anarchy?
Yes. This very recent show that started, 7 years ago or something, or 8 years ago, crossed my radar for... it's kind of messed up, I suppose. You guys might be aware there was a shootout in Waco a few weeks ago between bikers. And I was like, huh. I found myself kind of fascinated by the news reports. I was listening to a lot of discussion of it, like on NPR and stuff like that. And it was interesting to learn about the various outlaw biker gangs, how much they're tied to organized crime, at least some of them, and then the side of them that isn't, and, you know, where the balance was. And I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to watch some Sons of Anarchy episodes. I think I watched one like once some years ago, and I was like, that's pretty good, but not quite good enough for me to follow. But now I was in the mood, so I've been watching it. I'm about halfway through the first season, or a little over, and enjoying it. It's kind of trashy, but it's good. It's, Randy, you said that it's got some of the S.H.I.E.L.D. showrunners.
Yeah, it's Kurt Sutter who was one of the S.H.I.E.L.D. showrunners and also played the foot fetish maniac assassin.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I think I was telling you the other day, it reminded me of, like, actually watching S.H.I.E.L.D. Back in the day, the strike team, you know, the corrupt cops.
And
occasionally there was a hanging out with the Wild Boys kind of feel to them, and it was just kind of fun to hang out with the strike team.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's basically all Sons of Anarchy is that sort of side of it. There is a deeper side. It was pointed out to me when I had not realized that it is a Hamlet analog, too, a very kind of obvious one if you think about it, where the lead character is this guy whose father has died, his dad's old best friend is shacked up with his mom, and is moving the gang now in, like, sort of a direction that he's not sure of. His father is, you know, sort of speaking to him from beyond the grave via, like, an old manuscript he's found from him about how he felt that the Sons of Anarchy was moving in a bad direction. Of course, they're gun runners on the show.
Yep.
So there's all sorts of illegal stuff. There's killing. It is a trashy show. but I like, I mostly like the cast. The lead is honestly the weakest spot.
I've heard that. Charlie Hunnam is the lead, and I've heard people necessarily like him.
He's the Pacific Rim guy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I like all the side characters. I actually really ended up liking, Ron Perlman.
Ron Perlman,
I kind of had written him off as sort of a B-grade actor.
Yeah.
But he's got more to him than I thought in this. And Katie Sagal is particularly good as the kid's mom. And
she's always good.
She's like scary on it. Like I'm scared of her.
Yeah, as you should be.
Katie Sagal is great.
She was on Lost and she did great.
She was in the. She has a lot of range. You think of her as Peg Bundy, but she's got some range because she was
Futurama.
She was in Futurama and she played the mom in Pitch Perfect 2. And she's great in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she's ended up having a pretty nice and varied career.
She and Ed O'Neill both actually. They both started Married with Children, which was sort of the bottom of the basement kind sort of
trashier comedy,
lowbrow comedy, and they've both gone on to pretty great things.
Yes, yeah, they both had some talent. Anyway, I don't have a ton to say about it. I know it's an old show, but I will say if anybody did find their heads sort of wrapped around the biker mob stuff and had some curiosity. I'm pretty sure Sons of Anarchy is not an exact depiction of reality, but there's enough realism in there that and strong characterization that I think it's worth checking out if you're in the mood.
So I have one of my infrequent game nights this weekend.
Yeah.
Which neither of you bums came to.
We were deliberately excluding you and went off and had our own private game night.
I had a bunch of people come out and played. Played four games that I've not played before.
Yeah, it's crazy. You're like totally racking up the I've tried new games.
I'm at 19 for the year.
Wow.
How does he know that? Because he keeps lists.
Because I keep lists. Yep. I do.
Just like Liam Neeson.
I also have probably played more games this year than I have in a long time. So,
But the two I wanted to specifically single out, I played Castles of Mad King Ludwig, which is a game that has been getting a lot of raves on Board Game Geek. It was doing well for us and sells pretty well for us. And it is what I would say a combination of games like Agricola or Lords of Waterdeep, where there's a lot of different things you can do to win.
Right.
And like Carcassonne, because it's a tile-laying game, and at the end, you have scoring at the end, so you can sort of not know for sure who's going to win, which is always a welcome thing.
That's a good format.
So basically, it's got all these different pieces. They're all divided by square footage, so they're different sizes. Like they're either squares or like a little L shape or circles.
Uh-huh.
And everybody starts with their own foyer, which has four doors, and you have to connect everything by its doors. Like the pieces have like anywhere from one to four or five doors on them.
Uh-huh.
You connect them by doors. When you connect all of one kind, you get a bonus. Like if you finish a food room, there's a bonus for that. If you finish a garden room, you get 10,000 extra Deutschmarks to spend. And what you do is every turn, there's a master builder, which is a little white token, and the master builder pulls for whatever spaces there are available to pull more rooms out. There's like 10 rooms. There's a price there, like 15,000 all the way down to 1,000. And the master builder draws up the new ones and then places all the pieces, whether it's the new ones or the ones that have been sitting there, prices them accordingly. Like, oh, I want this room to be worth 15,000 this round, and this round to be worth 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a mix of, well, what do I want to buy, and what do I want other people to be able to afford? And then it goes around, and people pay the master builder for the rooms. So you get the round that you're the master builder, you get the money for the room.
Okay.
And then you spend money to the bank when you buy your room.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sort of trying to make a profit on that. And then basically the master builder moves every turn.
Okay.
And so everybody gets a chance to be the master builder. Everybody gets a chance to be the first person going. And it's you're building these castles. You also have these challenge cards that say like one of the ones I have was at the end of the game I get 2 points for every 350 square foot room I had. And there was one I had where you got 8 bonus points if you got all 10 different size rooms, which I didn't make. I tried really hard.
So people are going to end up with fairly varied castles of their own.
Varied castles, varied different rules as to what you're trying to do. You know, everybody may be going for the same type of thing because there's bonuses for food rooms that's the same across everybody. But then there's different challenges you get, you know, for the cards.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different – and there's also different favor tokens. There's a big stack of these circular favor tokens. You put four down for a four-player game, and those are other things that are victory conditions. Like this one had whoever had the most square footage of garden rooms or sleep rooms, and whoever had the most number of sleep rooms got a bonus.
Mm-hmm.
And then whoever had the most activity rooms, and then whoever had the most money.
Okay.
And the way it works is the first person gets 8 points, second place gets 4, third place gets 2, fourth place gets 1.
Okay.
So basically you're trying to get all these – so there's a lot of variety of ways you're trying to get points.
It does sound like the sort of scoring at the end of Carcassonne.
Yeah.
But
you know, who has the longest road, you know, whose castle is connected to the farmers.
Yeah, you know. It's got a lot of pieces and a lot of rules, but we found pretty quickly we figured it out and moved in. By the end of the game, we definitely were like, okay, now I know this game well enough, I'd like to play it again and see how it all works. But it's a really fun game. It looks like a lot of different variety, a lot of replayability.
That was like, your sort of big winner of the night, as far as...
Yeah, it was well, it might have been my favorite. I think the favorite of the group was Dixit, which is D-I-X-I-T.
That's a game I've been wanting to play for a while.
And Dixit has several different expansions and all that. Dixit is a fairly simple game. There's a set of cards. They all have images on them, these very beautiful images.
Yeah, and the cards, they're pretty amazing.
Everybody gets six cards, and basically on your turn, you choose one of your cards, and you come up with a code word. For example, if I had one, and you can use anything, like you can use pop culture, you can use sort of mood, and you put down a card. So I had a picture of a girl and sort of a crying tear, and if I put it down and said, like, Tim Burton, and could put it down. And then everyone, I put it down face down. Everybody goes to their hand and finds a card that could also describe that keyword and hands it to you.
Yeah.
Then you lay out all of them and people vote on which one they think is your card.
Oh, interesting.
And what you want to do is if everybody guesses your card, if you make it too obvious, you get no points and everybody gets points for guessing it. But if only one or two people guess your card, and everybody else guesses somebody else, then you get points and they get points. So what you want is a word that is good enough that somebody will get it, but not everybody will get it. Because if nobody gets it, you get no points.
Right.
And then other people get points for matching close enough. And sort of you're trying to get to 30 points or like six rounds.
It's an interesting – it sounds like an interesting test.
It's got some sort of abstraction to it. And like I said, the art is really beautiful. And it's really quick to pick up and play. A couple of people played. That was like their favorite game of the night. We played three or four rounds. It's a quick play game.
Nice. Quick play games are their own magical
version. Yeah. So those were my two big favorites of that. I also played Bang for the first time, not iPad, and liked that. And I can't remember what the other game was that I played. But we played a bunch of games. And Dixit and Castle of Magikem and Ludwig are definitely games I would recommend to people.
Cool. Maybe if you throw another one, I might deign to attend.
Maybe. All right. Well, that'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week. And until next time,
Yo-jo!
And that'll wrap it up for us this week. As always, you can drop us email with topic suggestions, things you want us to hear about, or just comments on the podcast at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at roguesgallery. Check us out on Facebook. Check out our website at www.roguesgallerytx.com. Check us out on Instagram at roguesgallerytx. And if you want to help us out, go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating and a little review. We'd very much appreciate it. And we will be back next week.